Which election is the biggest non-event in the history of quote-unquote democracy? You might say Pakistan, because ultimately, whoever the bosses want winning wins, irrespective of what the score is on the ground. You might even say China's, because Xi Jinping just got endorsed almost like president forever, but that really is not a democracy, irrespective of what the Russians say. You can talk about Erdogan and Turkey, but yet again, that is not as much of a non-event as something else that we are talking about today. That is the election in Russia. Why is an election in Russia such a non-event, even more so than in any of these strongman systems, which are not classical democracies? In fact, the New York Times has a story where a Russian official has been quoted as saying, look, this is not really a democracy. This is a very expensive exercise in bureaucracy, right? Having said that, why this is even more a non-event than any other is that for more than 20 years now, starting with 2000-2024 and then onwards, almost every year now, every election now, 2004, 2008, 2012, and then 2018, and now 2024, with every election, the same guy wins, no doubt about that, Vladimir Putin wins. But in each subsequent election, his vote percentage actually goes higher. In his first election, he got 53% of the vote. He became officiating president when Yeltsin suddenly resigned on 31st December 1999. So Putin became acting president. Election afterwards, he got 53% vote. Then going onwards from that, 53 became 71%, 63.6%, then 78%. And now in the election that's just taken place last week, he's got 88 to 90% of the vote, because the final counts are not in, but definitely between 88 and 90. In fact, if anything, this is an old line I've used before in some other context, in the context of some other countries and their so-called elections. I'd like to know what happened to the 10 or 11 or 12% who did not vote for Putin. In fact, even the three candidates against him, they were not really from political parties. They are members of the State Duma, and they are all three had rubber stamped some of the earlier decisions and amendments that the State Duma made, including the war in Ukraine, for example, against gay rights, and also for increasing curbs on free speech, etc. So it does look like this was an election designed to go only a certain way. You want to see how one-sided this is and how much of a non-event it is, unless you want to watch it for pure amusement. In the areas of Ukraine that the Russians have occupied, that Putin has occupied and has now annexed, in the Donetsk area, the vote percentage that he's got is currently being estimated upwards of 95%. Upwards of 95%. So it's that kind of elections taken place. Now see what's happened. He will now serve a six-year term, and I have featured some of these details in an earlier episode, 513 of Cut the Clutter, of which I will share a link with you. You can see it, but I will tell you some details as we go along. If he serves till 2030, as he will now with this majority, it's a six-year term. I will tell you how the six-year term came about. If he serves this, then he would have been president already for 30 years. Having been president for 30 years, beginning on 31st December 1999, he would have equaled Stalin. He would have equaled Stalin. And if he takes another term, because he made amendments to his constitution, whereby he can contest one more term, at least one more term after this, and he becomes president, then he would have been president longer than Stalin, longer than Catherine the Great Empress of the 18th century. And then the only one for him to beat in Russian history would probably be Peter the Great. That is 43 years. That will take some doing. That means in 2036, when he finishes at age 83, he takes one more term and maybe one more term. But who knows, with these strongman governments, where the strong men think they are there forever. In fact, in a New York Times article, which I am sharing with you, by Roger Cohen, the columnist, a columnist and a very fine writer, and he's traveled through Russia. He's been allowed to travel through Russia. He's traveled through Russia. And in that article, he quotes a person who says that, look, I have these children, these Russian children, teenagers, people little beyond teenage, they have not known any other president. So they don't ask who will the next president be. They ask who will the next Putin be. So that's the kind of figure Putin has now become. What is it that's driving this Putin's success? Now you might say he fixes his elections, which certainly he does, beginning with the fact that no one of any credibility can even contest against him. There was in fact a leader who thought he will oppose Putin, and he was an independent guy, and he was Boris Nazarbayev. Boris B. Nazarbayev actually collected enough signatures, popular signatures, that's a requirement in Russia, to contest against Putin. But what did they do? They declared most of those signatures invalid and threw him out. So he could not contest. So the only ones who contested were like His Majesty's loyal opposition. I'm making this up, the expression I'm making up. But these were people who really posed no challenge to Putin. Also, through the campaign, they did not criticize Putin. Now, whether they did not dare to criticize Putin, they wanted to, but dared not to, or because they knew that their role was just role-playing, no more. In any case, this election was won like that. The opposition, if anything, made a little symbolic protest by asking voters, by asking people to turn up suddenly at noon one day. So suddenly the lines were long. That was a kind of silent protest. That doesn't bother Putin. The other dissident, the only one who was challenging him openly and who was challenging him vocally, had international support, Alexei Navalny. We know what happened with him. He was jailed earlier. He was first poisoned through his underwear. That failed. He survived. He recovered in Germany. He went to Germany for treatment, recovered, and came back. He was, quote unquote, courageous enough or foolhardy enough to come back. He was jailed. He was then sentenced for 19 years in a maximum security isolation prison in the Arctic region. That is where he died all of a sudden. The state said he died of a cerebral hemorrhage. Talking to the media, talking to journalists after his victory, Vladimir Putin said he described this as an unfortunate incident. He also said that he had actually agreed to exchange him. He had agreed for a prisoner exchange in which Navalny would have been set free in exchange for somebody else. But he said the condition that would have been, then would have been that he will be exchanged, he would be sent away on the promise that he will never come back. In any case, circumstances conspired, I don't know what expression to use, circumstances conspired in such a way that Navalny will never come back anyway. It's his wife now who's running a kind of international campaign against Putin in the name of Navalny. But that challenge is over. Now, how is Putin winning like this in any case? Because even if he was fixing elections, in other countries we've seen elections are rigged, they are fixed, people come out on the street. So one, in Russia, people obviously have had a high tolerance of dictatorial governance. They saw it for a long time under the Tsars, then they saw it for a long time under the communists, under the Stalinists, under Lenin and Stalin, and now they have seen it under Putin for more than two decades. So really, the street protest culture hasn't built in, and wherever it came up, Putin has crushed it. So that hasn't come up. But at the same time, he has built a very strong combination of nationalism plus capitalism. So just as, say, in the case of Nazis, it was called nationalist socialism. In this case, it's nationalist capitalism. Many other countries have done it. Many other strongman rulers have done it, particularly in Latin America. So this is nationalist capitalism. In this system, he's opened up Russia. He's opened up the Russian economy, but within itself. He's opened up the Russian economy within itself, but shut it out to the Western world. And that, in a way, because he's packaged this in nationalism and he's painted the rest of the world, particularly, why should I say the rest of the world? I would say the Western world, as an enemy of Russia, which wants Russia to decline, melt away, get destroyed. He has led, and that's what mass leaders do, mass leaders, demagogues, they all do this. he has now talked his country into believing, that all of the West wants it to break up. So he's leading the Russian people into a civilizational conflict with the West. In fact, I take this line from Roger Cohen's article in the New York Times. And that is what seems to be working with a lot of his support base. One more important thing is that this is today a polarized world. So the Western world has a view on Russia. China has another view on Russia. India in this situation has nuanced its position, because India also has a very important old relationship with Russia. How important it is, I can do no better than bring back to you something that Prime Minister Modi said in 2014 during the BRICS summit in Brazil on his first bilateral meeting with Vladimir Putin. He said, and I quote from Prime Minister Modi, "Even a child in India, if asked who is India's best friend, will say Russia, because Russia has been with India in times of crisis." So Russia in India has a very special position, and that's what explains India's very nuanced view of the conflict and also of Putin's politics. The other thing that's happening is that a lot of the casualties in his armed forces, casualties are heavy, and I'll give you some details. Casualties are heavy in Ukraine, but those are all not coming from Moscow, St. Petersburg, regions where the Russian elites live. These are coming from distant regions, from the minorities. In fact, if I look at the analysis of casualties, it looks like that the largest group to die in Ukraine are not Russian professional soldiers. That's about 20%. A little more than that, 23%, 24% are prison inmates. In fact, if I look at the estimates, and there is an article in The Economist which I am sharing with you, they base it on the estimates by various organizations who pick it up from obituary notices in Russian media or from telephone conversations with families, etc., etc. So this is considered to be conservative. They reckon the deaths, not casualties, because casualties mean injuries also. They reckon the deaths to be anything between 55,000 to 80,000, of which about 23% are prison inmates. Most of these had been enlisted by Prigozhin's mercenary Wagner group, and we all know what happened with Prigozhin. And the future of his group right now is uncertain, but they are creating enough action, or they are carrying out enough action in Africa to pose or to build or to in fact increase the refugee or immigrant threat to Europe. So Putin works at various levels. He's operating through Wagner Group and other units in Syria, in Libya, in other parts of Africa. In fact, a lot of the Sahel region, now his people are operating, and those countries are breaking up. And how this works is that as those countries break up, they drive refugees out. And where do the refugees go? They don't come to Russia, they go to Europe. And that then becomes an indirect threat to Europe. In fact, I may be understating this by calling it an indirect threat. Actually, it becomes a direct threat, because in country after country in Europe, because resistance or anger over these immigrants is growing, because they are not assimilating in the local society. They are mostly also of the Islamic faith, of the very conservative stream. They don't settle in European environments. We've seen this happen in Sweden. We've seen this happen in Finland, Denmark, everywhere. And that's the reason in country after country, Italy, for example, the left is now losing and right is coming to power. And Putin sees the rise of the right in Europe as a positive thing for him. In fact, even in his speech and his statement, he said, when he was asked about the quality of his own democracy, he said, "This is good democracy. American democracy is bad." And he refers to what he sees as Americans using state power against Donald Trump. So he sees Donald Trump as a kind of an ally. And we can see why, because Donald Trump has said that if he comes to power, first of all, he says on day one, call a halt to the war in Ukraine. What that means is he's going to tell Zelensky, if Zelensky is still there, and Putin would likely still be there, that stop the war where you are and we will see, we'll start negotiating from here. That is his idea. His idea is not to immediately start giving more weapons to Zelensky and Ukraine to keep fighting. In fact, it's the Republicans in the US Congress who have blocked the American aid to Ukraine, and that's why Ukraine is now so short of ammunition and new armaments that they've been waiting for. So there's a stall there. So see how this is working for Putin. American democracy has stalled the supply or resupply of American armaments and ammunition to Ukraine, whereas his own quote-unquote democracy has given him another 6 years in power, unquestioned, even more unquestioned than before, and with an even larger vote percentage. So he is using what we might call as the strength of classical democracies, where voting is not one-sided. He is using that strength of the classical democracies, that philosophical strength of the classical democracies, as a strategic power for himself. And at the same time, what will be seen by conventional democracy watchers as a sham democracy in his own country, as strategic strength for himself. That is the big change that's taken place in Russia with these elections now. And that is what his statements have indicated. In fact, another of the things he said after winning was, he was asked, can there be a war with NATO? He said, these days, such a thing can't be ruled out. And he also made a reference to Macron, because Macron has made some very direct statements. I was about to say aggressive, but I held back because aggressive sounds like he's going to launch war. No, but to say that we can't let Putin win, this will be a defeat for NATO, this will be a defeat for Europe. At one point, he even said that NATO troops in Ukraine, the possibility of NATO troops can't be ruled out. Again, Putin has said that, look, these things are very dangerous because that will take us very close to World War III. Did he refer to Ukraine in his victory speech? He said, we need to carry out the tasks in the context of this special military operation. So in fact, he's responding to Macron and he's saying, President Macron has an opportunity, but that is not to launch a war or aggravate things. He has an opportunity to bring about peace and negotiations. So there is a quote from Putin, translated from Russian, which I'm reading out to you. And I quote, it is clear to everyone that this will be one step away from full-scale World War III. That is if NATO troops come into Ukraine. I think hardly anyone is interested in this. It seems that France could play a role. Everything isn't lost, and that is a role to bring about negotiations. And then he says, we are for peace talks, we want negotiations, but not just because the enemy is running out of bullets. So through peace talks, the enemy, in this case Ukraine, buys 1.5, 1.5 to 2 years of peace, he's saying that, and then rearms itself and fights again. Then more such statements come from Putin in the same vein. He says, no matter who or how much they want to intimidate us, no matter who or how much they want to suppress us, suppress our will, our consciousness, no one has ever succeeded in anything like this in history. It has not worked. It has not worked now, and it will not work in the future. Never. Now, think about Putin's old history and see where he has come from and at what a young age. 1989, he was a KGB colonel in Dresden, in Germany, East Germany. He was in East Germany, he was in Dresden in 1989, just a colonel. Then he was very upset that Soviet Union break up. In fact, in his speech in 2005, his big speech in 2005, he said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. Subsequently, he even said that the same breakup virus is now hitting Russia as well. That's when fighting in Georgia, Chechnya, etc. came by. There were two long wars in Chechnya. Now the Chechnya big boss, the Chechen big boss, is his big chapu, his big chamcha, his militia is also fighting alongside his troops. And his is like a rented army of Putin. So he fought two long wars in Chechnya, a very bloody war in Georgia, because he wasn't going to accept any further breakups of Russia. If anything, he is an irredentist who wanted to win back Russian territories. And that's how in 2014, he went and annexed Crimea. And the ease with which he was able to take Crimea maybe emboldened him or encouraged him to launch a full-fledged war more than 2 years back, just over 2 years back, except he forgot all strong men make these miscalculations because nobody around them can tell them that they are making a mistake. He forgot to note that all this while, for 8 years since 2014, Ukraine had been preparing to be invaded, and they had already got quite a bit of NATO and American equipment, and they had both. They had defensive equipment to defend themselves, but also tactical, strategic, and military understanding, education, and training to be able to stall the Russian advance. As we talk right now, the Russian advance is stalled. They've made small gains in the eastern sector, one village here, one village there. So definitely, Zelensky's counteroffensive last year failed. The Russian counteroffensive failed. Both counteroffensives failed. And as we have said in an earlier episode of Cut the Clutter, now it's a contest of who can defend better. It's in that situation that Putin now thinks that he has the lasting power. He can outlast the Ukrainians, because at some stage, Ukrainians, a much smaller country, because they've also suffered heavy casualties. Zelensky said formally that his country has lost the lives of 31,000 soldiers. The American agency, CIA, Department of Defense, they actually reckon these fatalities, not casualties, fatalities to be considerably higher. They might put them in the same ballpark as the economists' estimate of Russian casualties. Although, once again, if you go back to DOD, US Department of Defense and CIA, they reckon Russia's fatalities to be higher. Nevertheless, for a country, for a population of just over 4 crores, about one third of Russia's population, this is a very high number of fatalities. Now, if the Ukrainians do not get that pipeline, the aid pipeline flowing from the American side, it would look to Putin that he is winning just because he has the lasting power. And if you see some of the writings, say from Fareed Zakaria lately, those writings are now raising alarm that Putin actually is in a situation where he could win this war. So 1989, Colonel with KGB comes back because he's angry, he's upset that Soviet Union is broken up. So he comes back and he joins politics in St. Petersburg, where he becomes prominent very quickly. He's still in his early 40s. He's 1952 born. In fact, he's just 40, 41 at that point. That is when Yeltsin notices him. Yeltsin needs some strong people around him. So 1993, he comes back at the age of 41 and joins politics in St. Petersburg. Soon enough, Yeltsin notices him in 1998. At the age of 46, he's made director of FSB, Federal Security Bureau, which is the successor organization to the old famous or infamous KGB. At 46, he becomes head of FSB. The very next year, as Yeltsin is weakening, also his health is failing, Yeltsin makes him prime minister. December 31, the same year, Yeltsin resigns and Putin becomes active prime minister. 2000, he is inaugurated as president for the first time. Then elections, he won 53% of the vote, as I told you. And then it goes on from there. And I told you his vote percentage keeps going up. Please see this chart on your screen. When I used this chart the first time in 2020, I said the rise of Vladimir Putin. Now I have updated the chart. So I'm calling it the rise. So three times of Vladimir Putin. So if you see this chart now, you will also see with each election how his vote percentage has gone up. What he did meanwhile, now he had one problem. The problem was that the 1993 Russian constitution, which was based on the Western pattern, that said the president will now be limited to 2 terms. The president cannot have a third term. Putin didn't like it. So around time he was finishing his second term, he had to think of an idea. How can he retire at such a young age, right? You don't retire in your 50s and be an ex-president. You are not Obama or Clinton, right? So he had to think about something. So he thought of a stratagem. He appointed himself prime minister. There was no bar on anybody becoming prime minister having been president. So he made himself prime minister and made Dmitry Medvedev his president. That's when the Economist carried the famous cover story with Putin, with a very broad-chested Putin, with a portrait of Medvedev in his pocket saying, "I'm the prime minister, meet my president." So Medvedev became a convenient president while Putin ran the government as prime minister because power shifts where the man is, right? The title doesn't matter. By 2012, he said, all right, I've been president for two terms. I've been prime minister for a term. Now, the constitution only bars you from becoming president for two consecutive terms. There's no bar on my becoming president yet again. So now, as former prime minister or as incumbent prime minister, he contested, quote unquote, contested for president. But at the same time, he made amendments to give the president a six-year term. That term came up in 2018. Once again, he won a term at that point until 2024. And what did he do? He brought about another amendment, another series of stunning amendments to his constitution, which besides banning gay rights, etc., etc., one of the things it did was they reset the clock. They reset the presidential clock to zero, which means while you might say you can't have a third consecutive term, that law or that limitation now only comes in from 2024. So now, constitutionally, not theoretically, constitutionally, he's contested now. He's got one term and he can contest for one more term in 2030 until 2036. And who knows if he feels fit enough and if he feels willing enough and if he feels like he has nowhere else to go and nothing else to do. I can't go home and play golf or I can't live on a dacha. He might amend his constitution again. That's how he's perpetuating his rule, as almost nobody has done. Now, the important thing here is, and I will share one more story from The Economist with you, the most surprising thing that's happened in Russia and that has really worked for Putin is how well Russia's economy has done. So everybody had said that with sanctions, war, his economy will collapse. That hasn't happened. Initially, there was some recession in 2022. Since then, there's been quite a recovery. Last year, he had a growth rate of 3%. This year, official estimates, international agencies' estimates are about 2%, 1.7%. But the economist also says that that looks much too pessimistic. Looks like his economy will grow more. Partly it's because he has done a lot of spending, partly also because the big military industrial complex spending is taking place because a war also leads to a lot of consumption. He's increased his salaries of his armed forces have gone up, and the basic economic management has been good. His central bank has doubled interest rates. That has helped control inflation. It was 7.5. It was about 12-13% last year. We featured this in an episode of Cut the Clutter. Currently, it's running at 7.5%, and the estimates are this will come down to 4%. His overall economy is not large. His overall economy is still about a half of India's economy, the overall size of his GDP, of course, with a much, much smaller population, a population that is a little less than one-tenth of India's population. But still, if you compare this with America, America's economy is more than 14 times as large as Russia's. France's economy is 1.8 times large as Russia's. But in Russia, the important thing is that his elites are very happy. His elites are happy. His markets are doing not badly. If anything, this year, the same Economist article tells us, the Moscow Stock Exchange is going to see 20 IPOs, the launch of 20 IPOs. Again, what has worked for him is sanctions busting because So a lot of the companies that existed earlier, Western companies, have been taken over by local managements. For example, Starbucks is now running as Star. And because people drink coffee, people drink cola. So this has come up under other brands. All of that has worked. All of that sanction busting has worked. And then the oil exports, of course, he's exporting oil. A lot of it is coming, for example, to India, where India can, refineries in India can convert this into finished petroleum goods. And those can be even exported to Europe. All of this has enabled him to really fix his economy. And that's why the level of dissatisfaction in his population is not what it could have been if an economic collapse had taken place.